All right, I think we can start. Thanks to everybody for joining us today to this event. This is one of the public events organized by LISI, the LSE Research Unit on Southeast Europe. My name is Vasilis Panastigiotis, I'm the director of the Research Unit on Southeast Europe, and our remit is a focus on economic, social, and to some extent political developments in the region related more to the European perspective in the region. Today, we have the honor to have with us the governor of the Bank of Albania, Mr. Genseiko, who is going to talk to us about dealing with shocks at the gates of the EU, new monetary policy instruments, and the role of central banks. The role of central banks is, of course, very much in the attention of policy debates and media debates lately, with big increases in inflation, and also the debate about the role of central banks, not only controlling inflation through interest rates, but all the other responsibilities that are now bestowed in the banking, the central banking system, from financial stability to perhaps providing the framework conditions more generally for supporting economic growth and resilience to shocks, which is the new thing, if you want, for the last at least 10 years or so. So I hope we'll have, definitely we'll have the opportunity for a discussion after we hear from the governor and our discussant, Piros Kanagimohaksi. So let me, before I pass the floor to our speaker, let me say a few words by means of introduction for the two speakers. So Mr. Genseiko is the governor of the Bank of Albania. He's also chairman of the Supervisory Council of the bank. He's been in the role since 2015, and he's currently his second term governor of the bank. He's presided over very turbulent periods, years in the Balkans and in financial terms, and not only. I think, you know, he's very much seen as a source of stability, not only financial stability but also policy stability in the country and also more generally in the region. Mr. Seiko has an undergraduate degree in economics from the Faculty of Economics in the University of Tirana. And he has a master's degree in international accounting and financial management from the University of Glasgow, where he wrote his thesis on the role of banks and privatization of banks in transition economies. He has a very long and impressive career in central banking and in the commercial banking sector, with huge experience, I think, dealing with strategic and practical policy issues in monetary policy, in banking supervision, financial stability, and economic and financial aspects of financial markets. He started his career in the early 90s, serving as in several senior managerial and consulting positions, both at the Bank of Albania, but also in international consultancy agencies and banks operating in Albania. Prior to becoming governor, Mr. Seiko was the deputy general manager, head of retail of the retail department and branches network of Societe Generale in Albania. He also served as member of the Assets and Liabilities Committee, member of the Supervisory Council for Leasing in Societe Generale, and member of the Credit Committee of the same bank. He has a lot of experience, of course, with central banking, but also he has a very, very important and varied experience in the banking system more generally. And I think his insights today will be very, very helpful in sort of stimulating, if you want, a discussion about the challenges for monetary policy and beyond in Europe in general, perhaps, but definitely, as the title of the presentation says, at the gates of the EU for the countries who are in the association, a very prolonged association process to the European Union. Now, to perhaps place in a wider context the presentation, we have with us Ms. Piros Kanagimohaksi, which I have a difficulty in pronouncing, but almost perfect, who is an affiliate of LISI, but also a visiting professor in practice here at the LSE, at the Firoz Lajli Institute for Africa. She's also partner at the Macroeconomic Advisory Group. She has served as program director at LSE's Institute of Global Affairs, between 2015 and 2021. And before that, she was director for policy at the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, the EBRD, and also worked at various senior positions, including at the IMF. Piroska has also vast experience with the banking and financial system globally, and she's been involved in our collaboration with the Bank of Albania for a number of years now. So I think she not only understands the, if you want, the economics, so to speak of it, but also understands very much the policy and the policy context, especially in the Balkans of it. So, without further ado, I will pass the floor to the governor, and I think the presentation, the PowerPoint is up.
Yes. Thank you, Vasilis. So, thank you. It's always a pleasure to be here in LSE. It's not the first time. We have an agreement as the Central Bank of Albania with this reputational university, and part of this agreement is one day visiting and delivering a speech to LSE, but in the same time, we do a lot of activities with LSE University. We do a much larger conference in Albania, and also we do a lot of research exchange. So Vasilis and Piroska are our colleagues that we work very closely, and I'm always happy to be here. Previous presentations and speeches has been more closely to the, with the role of the central bank. So we were talking about macroeconomic and central bank role in terms of monetary policy and financial stability. While today, with the colleagues, we discussed and we thought that it would be more interesting to talk about, I mean, apart with the role of the central bank included, it's more interesting for the listeners and participants to listen about for you to listen more for the European integration of Western Balkans countries. So I'm going to talk shortly about the European integration process of Western Balkans and all the challenges. We have the title of the presentation of the speech is Dealing with Shocks at the Gates of EU. There are many implications and many problematics and many efforts which have been done during the transition for 30 years from all the six Western Balkan countries, but still there is a long road ahead that we have to follow. So I'm going through all this process very shortly from the point of view of a central bank, because basically the integration is much wider. We can talk for weeks about the integration challenges, but let's see it from a central banking point of view, the perspective of the European integration of Western Balkan countries. So, right. Always there is some technical problems in the beginning, sorry, but after they are resolved, no more problems.
Warm up.
It's just warm up, exactly. Yeah, you see, now it's warmed up. So this is the title of the presentation, and we're going to talk briefly about the Western Balkans, and what are the Western Balkans, even geographically, and then the EU integration process with all the implications. The third part will talk about the challenges and policy response about the shocks that I mentioned, and then the road ahead, what we should do and where we should be focused as a country with our structural reforms in order to achieve the convergence and integration process. So there is a map that is showing here, it's showing what is the Western Balkans. The Western Balkans, because it's like an expression, usually for the group of countries like ages ago and even now it's used that Eastern Europeans or Central Eastern European, CEE or WE, it looks like World Bank. Western Balkans, it's six countries, that is Serbia, Kosovo, Macedonia, Albania, North Macedonia now is called, Albania, Montenegro. If I forgot any other country, these are the countries, Western Balkans, and all these countries, these six countries, are surrounded by the European member countries. I mean, in the up north is Slovenia and Croatia, and then is Romania and Bulgaria, and we have Greece. In the south, but Albania is bordered, and then is Adriatic Sea, but in front is Italy. So basically, these six countries are surrounded, are just geographically located in the European community. So basically, even geographically, apart from many other implications, these countries logically should be members, should be part of EU. because there is no other way where this country should go since they are surrounded. In this slide, I am showing some more information about the Western Balkan countries that it could create to you the idea that how much is the population of each country and what is the GDP per capita for each country compared to European Union GDP per capita, and then the currency regime and the EU status membership. So we can see that in total, all these six countries are representing 17.2 million people. So the six Western Balkan countries are 17.2 million people. In fact, it should have been, the figures are coming from the recent census of the population, but the figure could have been more than 20 million, but a lot of immigration has happened from all these countries. People are immigrating in EU, Germany, France, Italy, from all countries, not only from Albania. Immigration is an issue. And nowadays is remaining and becoming a serious issue that we are losing workforce. Before we were saying that we were calling the brain drain, we are losing the educated people, but nowadays we are losing not only educated people, but we are losing also low educated people, so the workforce is leaving to you. So basically the GDP per capita of these countries is shown, well, in average is 6,000 euro, but each country is somehow, Montenegro has the highest figure and the other, and Serbia is the highest GDP per capita. And Kosovo has the lowest, but however, we see now some figures that show in GDP per capita for each country. For some countries, including Albania, but also Kosovo and others, some other countries. Former Yugoslavia, because all these countries are former Yugoslavian countries, except Albania. So before, I mean, these were composing the former Yugoslavia. Economically was better, but still had some problematics. In the year, after falling the communist regime, Albania GDP per capita, it was maybe no more than 400 euros or 300. I mean, it has been close to 300 euros in the year 92-93 when we measured for the first time. So we can see how much progress is being done, despite the fact that we represent only 32% of EU GDP per capita, still there is progress. And we'll show in other slides that the growth rate of these countries is faster than the growth rate of EU in terms of GDP. And then there is all the countries, I mean, there are four countries has the candidate status. I mean, Albania, Serbia, North Macedonia has already, and Montenegro has already taken the candidate status. It's only Kosovo and Bosnia and Herzegovina that are not yet having the candidate status, only for the political reason, because there are some political implications that will not go in deep. So in Western Balkans, the region has a steady, in this slide we'll show that there is a steady but somehow slow convergence to European Union living standards. We can see here GDP of each Western Balkan countries compared to EU GDP. And this is split in two decades, from 2000 and 2011, and from 2011 and 2022. So we can see the real convergence of the Western Balkan countries, and the convergence has been faster in the decade 2001-2011. It was fast in the second decade of transition, we call it, because the first decade of transition was 90-2000. Actually, the transition for all these countries started after the falling of the communist regime. It was faster, both unsustainable because of a largely domestic demand-driven growth model, rapid rise of external debt and other financial vulnerabilities, and a slowing down of structural reforms. Actually, there is a slow GDP growth in the second, I mean, in the period 2012-2022, because of necessary restructuring of the business model and tighter external financial conditions. Well, what happened is that before the global financial crisis of 2008, all these countries, and even in Eurozone, not only the Western Balkans, were growing faster. The global financial crisis of the year 2008 and later the sovereign debt financial crisis in Eurozone, followed then by the crisis in Greece and in some other countries, created some step back, some slowdown in terms of GDP growth of all these countries, but still the growth continued anyway. However, I mean, in the years 2000, 2011, in these decades, it was the perception of the people that we were progressing very fast on the integration in terms of economical growth. Apart from political implication, integration could come faster. But the global financial crisis created a shock that people understood that there is a longer road ahead. Here we can see that in terms of nominal convergence, the Western Balkan performance has been better. We can see the inflation. In terms of inflation compared to European Union, these countries, Western Balkan countries, has performed better. So inflation has been under control with average inflation on decreasing trend and inflation volatility lower. Basically, this is the only stronger domestic nominal anchor. Inflation, our primary job as a central bank is price stability, is keeping control, keeping inflation under control. This is all over the world. However, the monetary policy alone is not only the only instrument that can manage inflation. We can do with our monetary policy efforts to keep inflation under control, decrease or increase inflation, because last decade we were in a deflationary situation and we wanted to increase inflation, but now we want to decrease, to break the speed of inflation that is increasing. But on the other side, there is also the fiscal policy. There are also governmental part, there are other instruments that could be used or are used to keep inflation under control. However, inflation with a monetary policy, combination of monetary policy and fiscal policy of these countries, of all the countries, has been combined pretty well to keep inflation under control. So despite of many shocks that these countries are having, considering also that some countries are having their own currency and the exchange rate creates troubles, apart from two countries that are already having euro in usage, which is Montenegro and Kosovo. Other countries, sorry, are also exposed to FX risk. So in terms of nominal convergence, Western Balkans has been doing better than the real convergence towards EU. There is in this slide some indicators that are showing some elements which is competitive, inclusiveness of economic and political system, well governance and resilience of all these countries compared to Czech Republic. So we can see why we took as a comparison Czech Republic. Because the Czech Republic is a member country of EU, but it's one of the countries that has had the best performance in terms of European integration. It's maybe the top country in terms of macroeconomic parameters and integration process performance towards EU. We can see that in terms of competitive and inclusiveness, inclusive countries are somehow the same, but in terms of well governance and being resilient towards shocks and vulnerabilities, countries are showing different behavior. However, all countries, all Western Balkans, fall below. I mean, it's from 1 to 10. 10 is the best performance, and 1, there is no 1, but 0 is the worst performance. So, in this slide, there is a gravity-driven process of EU integration. So EU membership is an aspiration driven by geographical, cultural, and political reasons, of course. European Union is amongst the top three largest economic and trading areas in the world. So not only geographically, we are located there as we show, but basically we are talking for a large group of countries and with a big economy that definitely these countries, Western Balkans, wants to benefit. European Union is a global institutional and regulatory powerhouse, definitely it is. And European Union is the main economic, trade and financial partner of the Western Balkan countries. We will see in the other slides some other information and figures to show how much influence does the European Union has in these countries. So in terms of economic integration, European Union is the largest source of foreign direct investments, add remittances, sorry, and the largest destination of migration. In terms of trade integration, European Union accounts for more than 60% of the overall external trade with Western Balkans. And in terms of integration, European Union is the single largest investors and financial partner. So basically, there is a lot of ties with European Union. So now what I already mentioned is showing in these graphs in this slide, basically in terms of export imports, in terms of market share of European Union banks, FDI and remittances. So in terms of import exports, we can see each country how much European trade does they have in Western Balkans. So it's considerable. In terms of market share of European Union banks that are operating, the figure has been much larger before the global financial crisis. Before 6-7 years ago, definitely, especially in Albania, the domination, the participation of the market share of European Union banks were more than 60%. Now it's about 40, because many banks had the exit strategy from the region, still were having, even after the exit strategy of, for example, in Albania, but also in North Macedonia and some in Montenegro, Serbia too, there was an exit strategy of the Greek banks, French banks, some other European banks, because the countries are small, they have their own problems. All the European banks were performing very well, they were profitable in these countries, but on the other side, the global financial crisis created them troubles, and due to the ECB, European Central Bank instruction, they had to deleverage, either inject capital or close branches, subsidiaries. Since they didn't have enough capital, they decided to close the branches, and then the market share of these banks followed, and still, even it's obviously very high, the participation of EU banks in the Western Balkan countries. So it shows how much influence has the EU, financially speaking, in these countries. FDI stock, obviously, it's still, I mean, FDIs. These countries are open to international markets, not only to EU. They are open to FDIs, even from US. UK as well has a lot of interest. So there are countries out of EU that are investing, they are showing. So basically, there are interests from other countries, like Russia has a lot of interest, especially in Montenegro, that has a lower figure from EU. There is a lot of investment from Russian investors in Montenegro in terms of tourism, for example. China as well has interest. Turkey has interest to invest. So basically, still EU remains the main investor and the main trading partners in these countries. And in terms of remittances, we already mentioned, I already talked about the immigration. Most of the countries has a lot of immigrants. Immigration population moved from these countries to EU and other countries, UK as well, and US and so on. It's been ongoing for 30 years during all the transition, and it still continues. And this is a big problem, by the way, that we are suffering in our countries. Really, we should take it seriously in consideration to react with structural reforms in order to prevent this, because if it continues like that, after a couple of decades, maybe we have no more people at all. So we'll see. There is another slide as well that shows the influence of EU in Western Balkans. There are some indicators, like European Union is number one donor in Western Balkans. They have committed over 29.5 billion euros since 2007 to be spent for Western Balkans. It is number one investor for Western Balkans. European Union companies are by far the leading investor, accounting for 61% of foreign direct investment stock. EU accounts for almost 70% of the regional total trade in 2021. It's quite large figure. European Commission and European Investment Bank has put 3.3 billion euro to tackle COVID-19 pandemic and socio-economic recovery for Western Balkans. So it's considerable considering the size of the Western Balkans as a figure. And of course, it's about the region represents about 17 million customers, as you mentioned, about the population. So European integration is necessary, is useful, but it is also challenging for Western Balkans. European integration is necessary because prepares the candidate country for legal and institutional convergence. So it helps countries to modernize systems for accelerating the process of the European integration. Facilitates regulatory alignments and policy dialogue. Definitely, I mean, where each country, and we included, are working to adapt the legislation, first of all, and the regulatory framework. We are working in chapters, different chapters. Central Bank has got its own chapters, but each institution, okay? So, helps closing in some of the nominal and real convergence gaps, definitely. As transition economies, the process is necessary for Western, for the six countries, because it prepares them to withstand competitive pressure in the European Union and mitigates the risk of falling behind the reform agenda. Reform agenda is very important for all the countries, because without undertaking the structural reforms, there is no serious progress towards EU. The European integration process is useful. Your EU integration process serves as an anchor for structural reforms, of course, because we have to adapt the reforms of EU. It provides guidance and consistency to the reform agenda. It helps building social and political consensus to the cost of reforms. EU integration process helps attract private investors, or FDIs, definitely. It reduces perceived political and legal risk amongst the real and financial sector investors. It is very important for potential investors to have a risk perception, and the more process it is in European integration, the less risk is presented to potential investors or EU investors. The EU integration process allows for increased EU funding. All countries are benefiting from EU funds, or Western Balkan countries, like IPA funds, or funds, of course, are delivered to different projects, like in agriculture or tourism, but these are based on the projects presented and monitored by EU Commission. EU integration process helps improve domestic business and investment climate, definitely. Is important. The process is also challenging. The EU process is very challenging. Prolongation of the process from the EU might slow down or stall the EU integration. It creates disappointments from the candidate country that might decrease their appetite for structural reforms. This is very true. We have seen that prolongation of the process of the EU integration that has started since the beginning of transition, and now it's already almost 30 years. It's created a lot of disappointments, not only to the people for the process, but still people are looking forward for the EU integration, but also to the governments and institutions. Sometimes, I mean, a long process lose attention to the reform agenda. Institutions and leaders got disappointed, and they feel that they should change some agendas and follow up some other agenda, which is bad. And in this case, also EU member countries should be paying attention, so not to let the countries, Western Balkan countries, in terms of disappointments. And the increased economic and financial integration leads to an asymmetric exposure to the risks. Economic and financial shocks, policy and regulatory shocks. So let's go in chapter 3, policy challenge and policy response, that is dealing with EU-induced asymmetric shocks. There are real shocks, financial shocks, and policy and regulatory shocks that we will see. And then we'll see policy response in Albania, so we can talk for policy response in our country, but it is very similar to policy response of our country with that of the other countries of Western Balkans. We can see the real shocks in terms of asymmetry. There is a large degree of trade and economic exposure that opens the Western Balkans to asymmetric risks. So we can see the GDP growth of Western Balkans towards EU from the years in last decade, and we can say that high economic exposure to EU means large exposure to Western Balkans EU shocks. However, while EU-specific shocks affect the Western Balkans, the opposite is not true. Of course, the opposite is not true because we are a small region, and if there are troubles in the EU, definitely will influence the economic performance of Western Balkans. But if there are trouble in Western Balkans, will not influence the economic performance of EU. And in some extent, the troubles are very complex. It's not only social troubles, but economically, the monetary policies of, like the monetary policy of the central bank, great influence, because some countries are in euro, but even the countries that are having the local currency, euro is very much used. There is a high euroization of all these countries. In terms of financial shocks, there is a high financial integration that has a direct impact on the Western Balkan countries. The rapid GDP growth prior global financial crisis was partly driven by the business model of EU banks, characterized by external financing, relaxed lending standards, and inappropriate risk management. And the slow recovery after the global financial crisis was partly due to tight lending standards and low risk appetite, driven by tighter EU banking sector regulations, a thorough revision of EU banks' business models, and wide scale of EU bank deleveraging and de-risking. This is exactly what I said before, what I mentioned. I mean, global financial crisis created troubles to EU banks that withdrew from the Western Balkans. Some of them withdrew from Western Balkans, some remained. But this shows that what is the impact of financial shocks in the performance, economic performance of the Western Balkan countries. In terms of policy shocks, we can see that the accommodative European Central Bank monetary policy and its quantitative easing programs induced appreciation or deflationary pressures to these countries. So basically, what has happened is that the accommodative monetary policy, the very low interest rates followed by the European Central Bank, has created the inflationary pressure, appreciation pressure towards the Western Balkan countries. So considering the policy of easy monetary policy of EU has created some appreciating pressure, which shows that the local currency of our country, for example, is appreciating more than necessary and created troubles to the central bank for achieving inflation target. And on the other side, has created troubles to the exporters. So in this momentum, we decided to intervene in the market and buy euro. So, in one side, we are trying to to stabilize the foreign exchange market, not to stop the further appreciation of local currency and helping the exports of the country. And on the other side, we were consolidating the foreign reserve of the central bank, increasing the foreign reserve of the central bank. So, in this slide, we can see the policy response shock in Albania. So I can spend half an hour for each of them, but all these are very important. This is what we have done. Actually, this is what we have done in terms of reform agenda to manage all the crises and all the economic shocks that we have had. And for each part of these sentences written, we have spent a lot of energy and a lot of work. We know how much and how hard we work, but anyway, and they are all very important. And all, so in terms, I mean, I will not go through because we'll spend the time deadline that Vasilis is giving me. It's very important. Only with this slide, we can have another election. But anyway, I mean, in terms of monetary policy, we did what is written. I mean, these are all tools used by the monetary policy, like forward guidance, adapting the forex intervention when it was necessary, injecting liquidity in the market to help the financial institutions overcome the crisis, also the government to help the government. In terms of macroprudential policies, we use some tools to help the financial sector keep financial stability under control. And in terms of structural reforms, we were combining the work of the Central Bank, Ministry of Finance, and other supervisory agencies in the country, like Deposit Insurance Agency and Financial Supervisory Agency, to keep them together in terms of a group of financial stability of the country and take decisions for managing the reform agenda. We have had a high level of NPLs, non-performing loans, after the global financial crisis. So a very big reform to be mentioned is that one that we, together with the government of Albania, took.
Sorry.
So basically, now NPLs are not anymore this in a large, this large percentage. It was 25% NPLs, 25% versus total loan exposure, which is considerable. Now it's below 5%. But what we did, there was a long agenda of reforms. And then we have created, to protect the financial sector, we have established, we have approved the resolution law in the parliament and established the resolution entity, unit in Albania. And I will stop here because it's too much to say, but anyway, the reform so far has been, reforms in the financial sector has resulted effective. So all the steps and actions listed work. In this slide is almost the same intervention, showing by the period of time when we intervened with these actions and reforms necessary by the crisis of the times, and this starts from the 2006, for example, at the moment it was needed to discourage lending in foreign currency to avoid foreign exchange risk in the market, and this was undertaken at this period of time. And then in the year 2010 and 11, we easy financial stress to targeted forex intervention and increased liquidity injection. And if we can see here, over there is the NPL, I mean this column in pink is about the reform undertaken for NPLs in the year 2015 and 16. That was the moment that we introduced, that we undertook, but the reform continued and still continues the measures undertaken there. So here is in times, I mean, is the graph showing the reform agenda undertaken in time, in years, in order to keep financial stability under control and also to have macro stability in financial markets. So the road ahead, chapter 4, of course, there is a lot of road ahead. Our joint experience with the EU integration process revealed valuable lessons for all relevant parties, not only for Western Balkans, but also for EU. EU, in a certain moment, has understood that they should take it much more seriously, the European integration of Western Balkan countries. So basically, there have been some summits, and there is a lot of efforts from EU countries for the integration of Western Balkans. Now it's Berlin process ongoing, and there are efforts. Also, Western Balkan central banks has a crucial role, as we are doing in this process. All the central banks are sharing information with European Central Bank and IBA, and are getting some reforms they already mentioned. Western Balkans authorities, governments has a crucial role. Of course, the governments are trying to harmonize the efforts individually, but also in combination with each other in terms of Berlin process, but also all initiatives that are like Balkan Schengen or Open Balkans or all these things are to create a more unit market to be more attractive for foreign direct investments and be more integrative into the EU as soon as possible. The EU, what is the EU doing? The convergence challenges have forced EU to adopt more flexible approach, as I already mentioned. There is Vienna Initiative 1 and Vienna Initiative 2 that have helped to mitigate the delivery process. I just spoke with Piroshka 10 minutes ago for the Vienna Initiative. I mean, Piroshka has played a crucial role in this process for the Vienna Initiative, and now we are just following up. The process is still ongoing. In 2018, the EU Commission adopted a more transparent approach towards the EU integration. The EU established the Western Balkan Investment Framework to deliver a tailored economic investment plan. European Central Bank has also increased its flexibility towards the Western Balkan Central Banks, participation through participation of Western Balkan Central Banks in joint committees. We are participating as a non-decision taker, of course, but we are participating in many colleges together with European Central Bank. At least we are sharing the information what is happening with the large banks that have subsidiaries in our countries through the colleges with the central, with the ECB, and also financial agreements such as use of currency swaps in case of emergencies. ECB is offering, for example, 400, 500 million currency swap with each country. We are having one in Albania and we have already renewed. So there is a close cooperation with European Central Bank of all central banks of Western Balkan countries. Looking ahead, the EU should constantly monitor the process and periodically adjust its policies, adapt its new economic and political realities, of course, develop instruments to mitigate shocks in the region and show more solidarity. In terms of central banks, the road ahead, central banks has no primary role in the growth-enhancing structural policies, of course, has a very crucial role, not primary role, but a very crucial role in terms of EU integration process. Why we have a crucial role? Because we are not responsible only for the growth, but first of all, because we are responsible for growth too, but we are responsible for stability. Central banks should maintain monetary stability, price stability, and financial stability, which is a prerequisite for the European for the growth of the country, for the progress of the country, and then, in this sense, for the European integration process. Without monetary stability and financial stability, we cannot talk about the European integration in any case for any country. So basically, in this context, even legally, this is the main objective of the central banks, and we are really responsible for that work, and we are doing that work. About the Western Balkan countries' authorities, EU integration process is useful tool to foster structural reforms, align policies and regulations, upgrade domestic institutions, improve business and investment climate. However, the process is not without risk, like reform stalling and policy challenges. A realistic understanding of costs and benefits, as well as risk and rewards, is indeed. So basically, governments has a crucial role for the European integration process, because the entire reform agenda is to be undertaken, prepared, and followed by the governments of the countries. And the reform agenda is very wide. It's not only economic and financial, but it's social and it's in all aspects of economical and social life of a country. So basically, all countries are working hard, and all the governments are working hard, but there are also many obstacles and implications that creates delays, which are not due to the country's performance, but are also due to the EU performance itself. Because, unfortunately, what is happening is that when the countries of Western Balkans are performing better, well, I speak in overall, because sometimes some countries are progressing faster, some others slower, and so on, and vice versa. But in overall, when countries are performing and they have done the homeworks, the EU has its own problems, and the EU is not ready to work or combine the actions of accelerating the integration process. And vice versa, when the EU is paying attention to these countries more, it has happened historically like that, then countries have its own political troubles and they are not ready. So there is never a combination of EU, politically speaking, and Western Balkans in the same time to combine efforts. Otherwise, I mean, if it would have been like that, the European integration process would have been processing much faster. However, there is progress, but I will show now a slide that is this is the last slide, by the way, and this is with the EBRD data. Most of the indicators that we have taken in our presentation, all the indicators, not most, are taken from the EBRD. So the source of the figures is EBRD. It's not Bank of Albania, even though we are a credible institution and our figures are at the high level of credibility, but still we have done the presentation with EBRD data. And we can see the three scenarios of the European integration of Western Balkans, which are showing the year that when we are going in terms of GDP per capita to be fully integrated to the EU. So in terms of optimistic scenario, that you know, you all know that optimistic scenario never happens. So it's 2053. In terms of baseline or realistic scenario, is 2078, and the pessimistic scenario is 2220. So only by that, I mean, we should not show this slide to the
people. You'll not be able to verify
that. Because even if it is not 2220, even if it is 2100, people will be completely disappointed not following any reform. But anyway, these are the figures of EBRD, so we are presenting. So that is what I'm trying to say about the EU integration. Maybe I exceeded the line. I'm okay with the time. It is a very important process, definitely, for the Western Balkan countries. It should be understood, but by the people is being understood, at least in Albania, people has understood. There is a survey with the people in Albania about the European, about the EU, and more than 90% of the population, 90%, more than 90% is 95%, I think, but I don't know. Even are for the, of the people, population are for the EU integration. And similarly, in all the countries of Western Balkans, is this attitude towards the EU integration. Even countries with a Russian influence, like Serbia and Montenegro, or North Macedonia, with fewer, but still, even those countries, population in these countries and governments has the European integration agenda, and they are looking for towards European integration. So all the countries and population has understood that there is no other way, there is no other anchor or agenda except the EU integration, or there is no other better model to follow. So this is obvious. So for that reason, we are working. But hopefully we'll have more luck in the future to have a better combination of the reform agenda of Western Balkans with the EU, because sometimes even EU is showing some strange behavior for the future. So let's see what will happen and how the history will evolve. Thank you very much for your attention. This is what I wanted to say for the European integration of Western Balkans. And our country, Albania included. I don't know if it was informative enough for you, but we're here for questions and answers. So
thank you. Thank you, Governor. To central banking anyway, but it's also, you know, even more difficult, more than doing the Fed or the ECB, doing, you know, in the landscape that you described, problems institutional, of institutional transition, if you want, domestically, problems of the EU anchor, and as you were saying, sometimes it operates as an anchor, sometimes it doesn't exactly, there's problems of timing, the prolongation of the process, but also the shocks that may be coming also from the EU, be it ECB monetary policy or even, you know, even the issue of migration, you know, the presence of the EU is actually distorting the preferences of people about whether they invest in the country or they move abroad and so forth. And then, of course, you have to deal with a range of issues that go well beyond the traditional monetary policy, you know, tracking inflation, but also the less traditional monetary policy, which goes to financial stability and so forth. You also have to think about growth, structural reforms, how you support the you know, how you create the framework conditions that can support the process, which is ultimately a political process outside your remit. But I think you were a bit more optimistic on the question about shocks and the external actors included, you know, the 95% of people supporting the European orientation. But there's a lot of instability, and I think maybe Piroska will take us a bit in that direction without wanting to make you very pessimistic, I think.
Thank you very much, Mr. Govara. Thank you very much for your outstanding presentation, really so rich, and both in terms of presenting Albania in the broader context of the West Balkans in its relations with the EU, but also highlighting all the big challenges that are on the way. And some of them are, so most of them are positive, you know, the population support reflects that, but some of them are, can be controversial. And I think the experience of countries ahead of you, the EU10, including my original home country, Hungary, shows that these issues can crystallize later on, and how you handle that now the challenge actually can really impact outcomes down the road. And I assume the presentation will be available on the website, so,
yes.
so that because it's so rich, it's very useful to have it handy. So I saw that instead of being a discussant here, as such, I would pick on one particular aspect that you very much highlighted, and that is these are these asymmetric shocks from the EU and maybe broader from the advanced economy world to open emerging markets, and particularly open emerging European markets, such as Albania, still outside the EU. I will make three major points, I hope. I will look at the institutional performance of emerging markets, including Albania, and some of the lead advanced countries, the United States, the UK, the Eurozone, and suggest, I think, a little bit something provocative, but given that there's so many students here, which I'm delighted to see, I'm going to give you some ideas for a good paper and this idea. Then I'd like to go a little bit more in detail what is happening now in terms of the banking sector shock that we all are aware. You follow, I'm sure, the what has been happening in the US, the Silicon Valley Bank, and another signature bank and others, stress, how it has been handled, and its nature. You will have certainly seen the Credit Suisse shock, which had been long in the making, but the problems crystallizes partly because of the kind of contagion, indirect contagion from the US. And I'd like to suggest, I'd like to look at a few key points, which I think is important. And in addition to say, you know, tell you that, you know, these banks were mismanaged and didn't do the basic things, and there were some deeper issues that needs to be looked at on the policy side. And then finally, I'd like to offer some implications, and then that just challenge me. Particularly Mr. Governor, I'm sure, let's think collectively what it really means in our kind of modern digital age, what is happening. And that has, I think, direct repercussion for the West Balkans, not in the Eurozone, but in the very much in the gravity, as you said, of all the policies of the Eurozone Central Bank, the ECB. So point number one, research project. My thesis is that if you compare the institutional performance of emerging markets with those of advanced economic US, UK, etc., post-COVID, you see that emerging markets have performed superiorly, much better than advanced country economies in two fronts. And two are critical to what the central bank does, its mandate. One, in monetary policy. And post-COVID, you know, this demand-supply imbalance manifested itself in high inflation. In 2021, there was a rich debate in advanced countries whether this is temporary, whether just supply, and then you have to wait for the secondary effects. This, but so there's a lot of, you know, very rich and, you know, engaging debate a year long why inflation was just rapidly rising. Now that inflation was also rising in emerging markets, just they were not sitting on their laurels and didn't have the luxury to kind of, you know, ask whether this is just supply or the demand or the combination and there should be wage. They know, emerging markets know that when inflation is running high, it has the problems that it can entrench, it can, you know, unanchor expectations, and they acted fast. So Brazil, and then followed with a number of central banks, including the Bank of Albania, during the course of 2021, and raised interest rates, so started the policy tightening. Time is important, because if you act first, then you don't have to do too much, you delay your action, you have to do a lot to catch up and then and all that. In contrast, as you probably know, the US, the Federal Reserve, and the ECB, you know, had this beautiful debate about, you know, temporary or permanent inflation shocks, and didn't do anything. They delayed the action, and then when they finally, obviously, had to act, they really had to act in a massive way. And one of the most rapid increases that we saw in interest rates has happened in this period. And very rapid change, whether this is, you know, in the funding model or this is a policy, like in this case, can shock the system as such. So that's inflation. And then we see this massive financial sector shock, a banking sector shock from the US and Switzerland in the UK, of all places. So on also supervisory areas, emerging markets, we started to increase interest rates. Okay. Interest rates faster, and have seen, you know, did not see this type of stress that we see in advanced countries. And let me just, you know, say the obvious, these were very plain vanilla issues. These were not complicated derivatives, a la, you know, global financial crisis, but very simple, bad management and the reaction to rapid change. And policymakers missed it. Emerging markets institutionally have performed much better to date than advanced countries. I think it's historic, personally, and I hope that some of you will be interested in going into this and research and follow this thought. Now, what are the key factors that I think it's less, we have less stress, and then we'll discuss a little bit at the luncheon with the governor today, is that as much as it was a flawed business model, Silicon Valley Bank and, you know, fraud and other issues in Credit Suisse, there has been a supervisory failure. It's the job of the supervisor to pick, you know, monitor these things and react. Now the supervisors, which is in this case the San Francisco Fed in the Silicon Valley, sort of one of the some members of the Federal Reserve System in the US, knew of the problem. It's not that they didn't know, they knew, but they were not strong enough politically to act. It's the United States of America. It's not a little, you know, African, but sorry to say that. So, you know, an imaginary low-income country, you know, with emergencies. This is the most advanced, yeah. It's the central bank and the supervisor authority of the world reserve currency, for God's sake. Anyway, the CEO, of course, this failed bank was sitting on the board of the San Francisco Fed. If this would happen in an emerging market, you know, the central bank governor would be struck. So there was a regulator's failure. It's not that they didn't know, they knew, they did not want to act or couldn't want to act. There was discussion whether, you know, the stress test that they were not put under because they were lobbied up for that group could have caused this. No, the stress test of the Fed also failed to stress for interest rate increases. Why? Because the Fed was sleeping. It was still in this debate, should we act, should we not act, is it temporary, is it right? So they didn't really think that that inflation will be permanently high, and therefore they should act, you know, with interest rate increases, and the stress test, which some of you will be I'm sure you know, you'd be nicely engaged in the future as future central bank as regulators. It takes a time, it's a consensus process, you set the parameters and then you know, everybody agrees, so it takes about many months, etc. Bottom line, the stresses of 2022 did not have interest rate increases as part of it. It's mind-boggling. By the Fed, who was doing the stress test. The next point. We have to rethink, you know, what is systemic, because everything now is systemic in the banking sector. Mr. Governor, that's the rule. And I just want to remind ourselves, in the UK, you were not born, but during the early 1990s, there was the so-called small bank crisis. Tiny banks, 2.3% of GDP assets. Whereas the big banks had like 70-80% of GDP. So tiny. But their business model was very similar. So where one failed, what the contagion was is the similarity is the business model, not the linking, not because they were important size, not their not the other bank's exposure to those tiny units. But the business model was the same. So the contagion came from the smallness of the business model, and the small bank crisis is funny because the Bank of England, actually, I went and searched it, had a beautiful study of this years later, and it identified all the problems that you see and they themselves committed now when dealing with the subsidy of the Silicon Bank. So, it's not the size that matters, it's the similarity to the business model, and that's what we saw here, you know, that same deposit source, risk concentration, and the like. And in this digital age also, we have to rethink of what is the concept of bank run. Angelo was saying this is bank rush now, right? So from Silicon Bank Valley, 46 billion US dollar was taken out in a day. Now, how does it done? In the good classical way, which some of us remember, when it was a bank crisis, then the depositors were queuing up in front of the bank, they trying to get back, you know, $1,000 for the local currency, etc., as much as that. No, here, with the click of your fingers, you move your all of your deposits, right? So this is, it's the new era. The bank run is not bank run, it's the bank rush. In sort of a speed light manner. So when it happens like this, not stretched up as a small bank crisis, for example, for years in the UK. Next, government securities, which carry in the Basel regulation sort of zero risk when you have it in your bank portfolio. So government securities are really not risk-free if the interest risk is not hedged. It's also, we have to think about this now. There's a lot of government securities on everybody's balance sheet, particularly following the massive QE as the government highlighted. First, the global financial crisis, and then, of course, the pandemic. So, what they are most risky. At this point, they are risky, right? On the balance sheets. The whole resolution mechanism. The resolution mechanism is when you have to close a bank. And then, after the global financial crisis, there was a long process. Years of huge amount of human capital, the best minds in the industry worked out the best possible bank resolution system, whom you bail out, whom you bail in, so who has to pay, what type of debt was it, insurance you build up, and it failed. Both the US regulators, the Fed, and the Credit Suisse completely disregarded the agreed rules. So the resolution, there's somebody was removing that the bank resolution works only if the government is resolute. There was no resolution and no failure. No, and the system failed. And as a result of all this, and this is another research project I want to suggest to you, as a result of this, you have a banking sector that the government slash the central banks of the authorities effectively guarantee all the liabilities of the banks. Banks cannot fail on the liability side. And they also guarantee part of the assets, because for the Fed is not guarantees the price of government securities. So you don't have to mark to market, so they can keep this as we did. So they liability already a digital central bank money, and part of the assets is acting like a digital central bank money, which makes the case for digital central bank currencies. I know the governor is a little bit wary about this, but unfortunately, this crisis and the distress, that's not a crisis, but this distress highlighted that you know, this is what's happening de facto, whether one prefers central bank digital currencies or not. What are the implications? And that's my final point. Number one is that there is no good option. Because there's no good option. There are situations when the financial policy objective, the three, sort of the reasonable growth, price stability and financial stability, you cannot achieve at the same time. And this is unfortunately a situation. I'm not going to we can discuss it. There is some optimistic view that actually you can deal with this because central banks, like the Bank of Albania, would have maybe less but more advanced countries, but maybe they have two tools for two goals. Just as you know, that's in theory it works. You have one tool, the interest rate policy for fighting inflation, and the other tool, balance sheet policy of the central bank for stability reasons. But the two are linked. The distinction is blurred. So I am not that optimistic as others. Second, the whole regulatory system. The whole regulatory system has to be rethought, and that is a very serious thing. So the Basel system, the whole regulatory system of banks, is in shambles. Rules are disregarded on every single possible way that you know, for long years has done. Now, there is one finally a point that is directly relevant for West Balkan countries and the Bank of Albania, and relates to the point that the governor made about currency swaps and repos. Right? So currency swaps are tools of systemic central banks, as the Fed, the ECB, a little bit the People's Bank of China, but it's a very different animal. But there is some similarities. They offer that in case there is a shortage of liquidity in their own like local currency, dollar or euro, they offer it in exchange for local liable assets of a country or in exchange of a hard currency asset. Now, typically, countries, including Bank of Albania, but others also, got not the swaps when you really give your local currency basically and the ECB gives you euros, which is really what's helpful in a case of stress, but they got the repos. You had to have high quality euro collateral in order to get euro cash. Even that is helpful, but I like to suggest that if, and that's what we see, when there is a big crisis from, you know, the advanced world, the Fed, and the ECB, the Eurozone, it's less than not the Eurozone, not the Swiss, Switzerland, but part of the European family. Central banks should give only swaps to countries where foreign banks operate. Their foreign banks based, still probably like half of the foreign banks are still EU-based. So if the stress is coming from that, and these banks are operating in a highly euroized context, then the countries, the governor's central bank should get the real true help, the currency swap, and not the repos where you have to have already something with a high quality euro. It would be a little bit of a revolutionary thing that I think would make all the sense. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Oscar. That's a lot, many points, and we will definitely not have the time to discuss all of them, but very, very important points. I will say a couple of things while you collect your thoughts and prepare yourself to ask your questions. Please identify yourself by raising your hand if you want to. Or your finger to ask a question. But let me bring it a bit more to, I mean, both presentations a bit more to my own interest, and if you want, to my academic background. And I would like at some point, if you get the opportunity, to relate to this point that maybe we move from a period where we're completely oblivious about financial stability. We're thinking, oh, the central bank is just doing interest rates. Targeting inflation, and then perhaps, you know, a subject to that, facilitating or looking at employment, unemployment, the real economy. Maybe we've done too radical a shift, and we think too much about financial stability in a way that creates this kind of self-fulfilling environment, where because everybody's too afraid about contagion and about you know, how even a very small thing, a bank or place or whatever, can create a systemic crisis, then we self-inflict that to ourselves by allowing it to happen. We had a bit of discussion earlier, more privately, about whether, you know, we should let banks fail in the same way that we let businesses fail. You know, if a corner shop fails, we don't bail it out, although it may have implications for the neighborhood, and who knows, you know, what may happen. And I wonder whether this is something which is not about sort of the bank itself, but about the signals you send to the financial markets. Because otherwise, as you said, Piroska, this is impossible. You know, the message is completely pessimistic. You know, we're always at the mercy of the next, not policy mistake, but mistake in the interaction between policy, the regulators, and the financial system, or even small banks. So I wonder whether there is a point where we have to reflect and reset a bit the targets on that. So I will not invite you to answer this question. Keep it in mind, and I will bring questions from the audience. Bernard?
Gabriel, Casey. Sometimes in Velocity and sometimes in other places. I wanted to get away from the immediacy of crises, whatever they are, and to think a little bit more about the long term. You were talking as a central banker. What you did not mention at all was the role of the multinational development banks, although you were citing the EBRD's statistics quite frequently, Sir Benesis. Is there a role for multinational development banks? Is there a role for banks, particularly like the EBRD, in assisting this transition process? And in particular, this is a contribution to the longer term development of the countries and the objective of their convergence with the rest of Europe. Is there a role for them? What is that role? How important is that role? Thank you.
Would you like to answer
one by one? Or
please answer now.
So I will answer briefly to manage the time, so I'm going to go one by one. There is a definitely very important and crucial role of European EBRD specifically, with funds for specific projects and with technical assistance for the Albanian government and for the Bank of Albania and for other institutions within the Bank of Albania and independent institutions. So EBRD has a role, is present in this country. So, of course, the role of the BRD contributes to European integration, country development, and helping very important strategic sectors of economy like tourism, agriculture, for example. Recently, BRD is supporting very much agriculture because Albania is an agricultural country. But due to certain factors, agriculture is not progressive enough, but there is huge potential. So EBRD investing through direct injection of money or with technical assistance is trying to support this industry to progress better. So there is a role, of course. I mean, there is a role of EBRD, sorry, from multinational international banks in Albania and in the region. There is no other. There is the World Bank definitely playing the role as everywhere. IMF, of course, is playing the role as everywhere. So World Bank and the EBRD are spending, investing in countries' infrastructure and sectors of economy, but also providing technical assistance. So they're bringing not only money, but also know-how, a lot of know-how. They have been beneficiaries as an institution, but I know that other institutions have been beneficiaries of this know-how, not only investing, but know-how. Know-how is very important. It's more important sometimes than the money. In some institutions, it's really important. If you set up a good know-how, a good institutional know-how, and then the community is more stable.
Hi, yeah, my name is Daniel. I'm studying the Master in Political Economy of Europe. First of all, thank you, Mr. Governor. And I had a question about taking into account the post-pandemic context and the current inflation crisis affecting the continent. How are the negotiations with Brussels going on fiscal convergence for integration? Can you recognize a different stance of the EU, or is it basically the same as after the Eurozone crisis?
How is about the fiscal convergence after
fiscal
pandemic?
Convergence for integration?
Well,
let me take another question also where it's asking language.
Yes, thank you again for the presentation. One line observation. I mean, on bailouts, I think one's lost the distinction bailing out institutions and bailing out the individuals involved. And the problem with 2008 is none of the individuals involved got, they're just sort of fines, which, I mean, so. Two questions. You get a very, it's integration of the Western Balkans as a whole. And you explain why it's useful to go as a whole because you have a Schengen group, whatever. On the other hand, is there a case for being individual? I mean, are you being held back by the slowest? Is there more incentive if you just handle yourself? And how would the EU handle it? Is the EU, would it be able to move more quickly if Albania's, it's not the sixth, it's the one? I mean, do a Croatia break on from the others? Is there something there? My other one is the final speech which Mark Carney gave as Bank of England governor, who was at Birkbeck College, on macroprudential. And he looked at potential conflict between anti-inflation and financial stability. And he concluded under some conditions, you let the inflation target go if you need to preserve financial stability for the model to show why it has less losses. Do you see any conflict, a potential conflict between your financial stability objective and your inflation? And would you consider how you might, how you might address the trade-off?
Okay. I start answering Daniel's question. Basically, in terms of fiscal convergence, because we as a central bank, first of all, is in charge for monetary policy, fiscal policy is an attribute of Ministry of Finance, the government. So we combine policies, of course, we share information, but legally, the responsibility and the attribute of fiscal policy is directly Ministry of Finance, and Ministry of Finance, same as the central bank, government in overall, but Ministry of Finance, it's an institution within the government that I could say, in a country like ours, is the most important institution. Because there is an importance in agriculture, there is a ministry for that, there is an importance of tourism, there is a ministry for that, but finance, it manages the state budget, and fiscal policy is very, very important in this case. So basically, they are doing the same as we are doing. Harmonizing, following up, reform, they have the set of requirements and reforms to be undertaken. Generally, we are following a consolidated fiscal policy because countries, our country has a high debt versus GDP. It's now it's lower than 70% because we are decreasing, but there is a process to decrease the debt, to make the country more competitive versus the other countries and decrease the risk of the country and so on. Still, during pandemic, because you mentioned pandemic, all countries increased the debt. They waived the rule of debt, respecting the fiscal policy consolidation, decreasing the debt because they needed money, otherwise everybody will die. So this rule were put it aside, and now we're going back to this rule, and all the activity and the policy, the strategic policy, fiscal consolidation, and other policies of the fiscal policy are in convergence with EU. EU, I mean, countries like developing countries, countries in transition, like Western Balkans, but all over the world, are working with the help of international institutions like IMF and World Bank and EBRD and other international, but also are being monitored with international institutions like EU as well. It's one of the European Commission specifically. It follows the performance of the reforms, same as IMF does and the World Bank does. So basically, we're going periodically. Public authorities go to Brussels reporting for the progress. But periodically, for example, I met members of the Albanian government and Albanian parliament, position and opposition. When we were at the airport, they were going to Brussels. I was coming here, and they are going to report. So definitely, there is a convergence with EU fiscal policy of all these countries. So this is going in detail, it's not interesting. Boring, but anyway, this is the answer. The question about the, it's a very good question, you're right, but why? I mean, this is, I don't want to get longer. Definitely, individually, could be easier. So why we should wait one country or the other country? And sometimes the delay of one country is just because of the other country. Because when they decide for EU is seeing the region as a package because it's only 17 million people and these six countries, small portion of the countries. And in some sense, it's better to have the integration of the entire region to develop the countries. That's why there are this Berlin process and these initiatives to make the region more attractive on one side because direct investors, foreign direct investors, and if they see small markets are not interested. But on the other side, countries have historical conflict and ethnical conflict with each other. They've been fighting like former Yugoslavia's countries. It started with Croatia, then with Serbia, latest it was Kosovo. So even 20 years ago, they were killing each other, like Ukraine with Russia today. So it's not only the process, economic process and political conflicts, but also historical conflicts and ethnic conflicts. And these countries in process of integration will get peace as well. It's not only the matter of progressing economically, but they should get peace first of all. Because if they don't get peace, what kind of integration they could have? They will kill each other again. I mean, and it is the model of EU is also for the reason what happened after the Second World War. We all know that German, French, and all Europe killed each other, but then it has the model of developing, and everything is left behind. The history is not forgotten, but people are working together, are getting together, so this is the model of these countries to be replicated in terms of. That's why EU is putting the reform agenda for Western Balkans. If it's possible, definitely it's easier, because North Macedonia was held in the process at a certain moment, because Serbia and Montenegro are faster in the process. They have done more progress. Economically speaking, they are better. They have done a progress. They have open negotiations earlier. Kosovo economically is weaker, but also some countries has not recognized yet, so has political problems. Albania and North Macedonia were in negotiations were opened recently together. In the beginning, I mean, Albania had its own issues, Macedonia has its own issues. Macedonia was big, Albania were becoming an issue for processing Macedonia in certain moment. Then Macedonia was becoming an issue for accepting Albania. In one moment, Albania was said, I mean, because of the name, Macedonia agreed for the name, but Bulgaria came after and blocked after the name. And then they were saying, okay, but wait, we don't open it for you. Of course, they can open individually. The process is like that. There are economical and political implications. That's why they are trying to put all the region together. Because if sometimes negotiations are being used, I mean, this is not good, but it's a fact. Like if we have problems with Greece, for example, historical problems, property problems, Greece is threatening, shut up because we don't support you for the European integration. We shut up. If there are problems between Serbia and Kosovo, I mean, European is telling Serbia, shut up, because we don't, we stop you. If you have to do, you have to recognize Kosovo because we don't support you for the European integration. They withdraw. So even political issues between countries are being used because countries alone are not able to negotiate or get this peaceful consensus. They cannot overcome. So that's why.
Governor, we have run out of time, would like you to invite you to answer the second question about the
monetary policy and financial stability.
And then I'll pass also the floor to Vinoska to say something about that because it touched upon, upon that question. But if both of you can promise me to give me a 2-minute answer.
Okay.
Time starts.
The second, I mean financial, definitely. The monetary policy, the interest rates, when we take decisions, are seen linked with financial stability effects because, so we discussed during the last time, financial stability is quite important, it's the same important, even more sometimes, than price stability. And always they have implications, vice versa. Losing financial stability will lose also the price stability because we'll have effects, negative effects to the inflation and so on. So it's definitely needed that any central banker will take it in consideration both sides. Without taking consideration both sides, it doesn't work. So in this case, I believe in, while there is a lot of debate and controversial effects of monetary policy to the financial, especially interest rates, even the recent what happened with the banks was because of monetary policy. But it's not only because of monetary policy, it's because of what Piroshka said, the supervisors were sleeping. Because if supervisors opened the eyes, they could get precautions, they could get measures to prevent this failure of them. Anyway, definitely, I mean, it should be taken into consideration, and we are taking. Otherwise, we don't want to be confronting surprises like Silicon Valley Bank. So, yes, 2 minutes is okay.
Thank you. And for the last word.
Shorter than that, in the current setting, I think it is pretty much a mission impossible for the major central banks. They lost a lot of credibility on the inflation front because they were sleeping at the and they lost again for other reasons because they disregarded the rules that had been worked out. They lost credibility on the stability front. And this is a tough time, as we discussed. So even that you feel me about it, it's a vision impossible that we have to do.
So
it.
So when I suggested that you can give a more pessimistic view, I didn't mean that.
I'm not the vision impossible. Let me just survive.
Okay. Well, on that very nice mission impossible note, I'm afraid we have to bring this into closure. I forgot to mention, I should have mentioned, I apologize for that the event is also co-organized with the Financial Market Groups, Markets Group at the LSE. And of course, thanks also to the FMC for their support. We may have a bit of time for if somebody didn't have the opportunity to ask a question as we say goodbye to ask a quick question. But otherwise, thank you all for coming and please join me in thanking our speakers, the Governor of the Bank of Albania.